Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Ian Gardner with another fantastic episode. Alex McCauley joined us today. So Alex, if you don't know, was the founding CEO at Startup Oz, which was a sort of startup industry lobby group is maybe the simple way. You know, they sort of represented the startup sector to the government and I guess the public as well. Been doing that for 6 years, kind of unbelievably. I've known him the whole way through. Lovely guy. He was actually coming to us from his dorm room in Stanford. So he's headed over there to do an accelerated MBA, which we talk a little bit about. The big news and part of the reason we got him the show is that Startup Oz has morphed into the Tech Council. So it's kind of, you know, Startup Oz in a sort of, you know, it's like the Captain America, you put them in the machine and they come out much stronger. And it's not that they went into the machine as a weedy kid and came out as this sort of buff human. That's probably an unfair analogy, but there's something to it. There is a lot of weight behind this organization now, just an unbelievably powerful and impressive group of founding members and board members, which we'll get into. So I'm really excited for the sector, really excited for Alex, you know, because I think it's a great way to hand on his legacy from what he's done with Startup Oz. And yeah, really excited to see the impact that the Tech Council is going to have. So I've known Alex for quite a number of years now. I think he's an amazing guy, very intelligent, very dynamic, very passionate, loves the sector. And yeah, look, I think you'll enjoy this conversation because I certainly did. So here is my chat with Alex. All right. Welcome, everyone. I am sitting here in lockdown Bondi Junction staring at our very good looking Alex McCauley. Apparently, Alex is in Stanford. So, Alex, before you tell us about Stanford, why don't you just give us the very quick potted bio as to why you're on the show?
Yeah. So, and hello from sunny California.
Yeah. I told you not to until later.
So for the last 6 years or so, I've been running an organization that some of your listeners will hopefully be familiar with, called Startup Oz. We did until recently, basically government policy advocacy for tech startups. So it's a long way of saying that we were trying to be the voice for Australian tech startups with government. And so we'd work on things like trying to get the visa settings right for Australian tech companies to access the best talent in the world, trying to get the tax settings right to help get venture capital money into Australia. Way back in 2015, before I even joined the organization, we were working on employee share schemes and trying to make sure that companies could issue equity to their employees without there being a huge tax burden on those employees. So that sort of stuff where there are settings that you need to get right to help companies start and then thrive.
Yeah, so basically an advocacy group for the startup industry, mostly into government. Is that kind of fair?
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose there's also a piece of it, which is, you know, advocacy with the public, trying to let people know what startups are about and why we should care about them.
Yeah. All right. I said we'll get back to Stanford in a second, but so 6 years. I mean, that's a great innings for anyone, especially at the golden years of your career, not the golden years, that makes you sound old, but you are very young. The best years of your career, I should probably put. Let's ask a broad question to start with. I mean, the startup ecosystem in Australia, I mean, 6 years ago, it didn't really, I mean, it existed, but it wasn't that great. And Startup Oz has certainly played a role in improving it and fostering the stuff you're doing. So how do you feel the ecosystem is doing right now?
Yeah, well, let me first say I didn't always expect it would be 6 years. I got the job back at the start of 2016, having been working with Startup Oz for 5 or 6 months already. And the board said to me, okay, well, you can be the CEO, but you've got 4 weeks runway and we don't have any money after that. So good luck to you. And if you survive 12 or 18 months, we'll be very happy. So the 6 years was really in the picture, I have to say. So it sort of just panned out that way. Look, it's been an incredible, incredible growth period for the startup sector in Australia over the last half decade. Before I came to join Startup Oz, I was actually in Israel for 3 years as a diplomat in Israel working for the Australian government. And so I got this really stark contrast, you know, leaving Sydney to go to Israel and then coming back 3 years later. In 2015 and joining Startup Oz, and could really kind of see the contrast between, firstly, the difference between what was happening in 2012 to 2015 in Sydney, and there was significant growth in that time. And then working day to day in the sector over the last 5 years, it has just been an explosion. there's no other way to put it, I think, in terms of the amount of capital under management in the venture funds in Australia, in terms of the activity for angels, in terms of the number of companies worth $1 billion, worth $100 million, just an enormous amount of success, I think, driven by really innovative, passionate founders. So that's actually been a real thrill. You said that.
Well, let me ask the question in a slightly more granular way, and maybe try and bring in some comparatives. I mean, so there's no doubt that the ecosystem is head and shoulder, night and day from where it was when you started. But that is probably true for, in fact, it is true for ecosystems all around the world. So we have improved, but have we improved relative to others? How do you think we're doing relative to the international ecosystems?
Look, I think actually, it's hard to say across the board. I think, you know, when you're coming from a low base, it's easy to grow much faster. And I think we have grown much faster in absolute terms than lots of those other sort of more established ecosystems, including Tel Aviv and a few other places. And we're really starting to see the fruits of that now. But I'm not totally sure that the relative comparison is all that important, actually, for Australia. I think we are now producing the kind of companies that we couldn't produce 5 or 10 years ago. Back sort of even when I started with Startup Oz back in 2015, the mantra was, if you want to raise a big round of capital, you got to go to Silicon Valley. If you needed $10 million or more, you were offshore and you were relocating. And we're seeing that all the time with founders. And that just isn't the case anymore. So in lots of ways, we've got the fundamentals now to produce great companies. And sort of doesn't matter what else is happening around the world if we've got that base.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, like some of the astonishing recent successes. I mean, we often think of Atlassian as the shining example, but you know they're 20 years old almost, maybe a little less.
Yeah, overnight success.
You know, Afterpay, and, yeah, correct. But Afterpay, I mean, incredible success. Canva on that trajectory. I mean, and there's others emerging too. So I think we have to look back with some pride in the fact that they were created here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Afterpay was founded in 2015. And I think if it had been founded 5 years before that, it might not have ended up being in Australia if one of them wanted to raise some capital. Canva was founded in 2012. If they'd been founded 5 years before that, they might not have ended up staying in Australia. I think that story is probably true of a lot of our most successful companies. And I think we should be really proud of the fact that we're generating the conditions to allow successful, ambitious Aussie founders to stay in Australia. And as Didier Elzinger, the CEO of CultureAmp, says, you know, build local, sell global, which I think is a really great phrase. And it's something that lots of founders have really taken up.
One of the other things that Startup Oz was well known for was the Crossroads report. And I think you've published 4 or 5 versions of that. Is it 6 now? Wow. That's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears because you're one of the key authors in that. So, I mean, tell us about Crossroads and what effect you think that had and how important you think it is.
Yeah, look, I joined Startup Oz basically on the strength of the Crossroads. When I joined, I picked it up for the first time at an event with Malcolm Turnbull at Fishburners, and I sort of read it and was hooked by with a 100-page research report. You know, I sort of took it home and digested it. It was being written by a bloke up in Queensland called Colin Kinner at that time. So he's a great guy and knows a lot about this stuff. And he kept writing it for a little while after I came on. But basically, I mean, I think it's sort of the one-stop shop for policymakers when they want to try and get to grips with what's happening in Australian startups. And I think for lots of people in the industry as well, it's sort of the Bible about what's been going on across the year for startups in Australia. And we didn't produce it last year, actually. There wasn't a 2020 Crossroads for the first time in 5 or 6 years, mostly because of COVID. But we will go back to producing it this year. The Tech Council, this new organization has taken on responsibility for all of Startup Oz's stuff, including producing the Crossroads. So we'll be back at the end of this year.
All right, look, that is a great segue because we shouldn't dwell on the past with Startup Oz, but you know, I guess just to maybe put a full stop in that. I mean, congrats on the journey so far. I think it's been great, and you have made a material impact on the sector. But there's something new. I mean, the reality is Startup Oz has evolved into the Tech Council. It's got a new name. It's got new board. I mean, you're stepping out. I mean, that's part of the reason that you're in Stanford. Tell us how this all happened and why.
Yeah, I mean, really the catalyst for this was that for some years, we at Startup Oz were working with lots of companies that weren't startups anymore. They'd been really successful since, 2012 when they were founded, if you were Canva, or 2015 if you were Afterpay. And suddenly they had problems that weren't the problems of startups and early growth companies. They were the problems of genuine global tech firms, but we were still, their channel to government. And so, for me, that really told the story of, well, actually the needs of the industry have changed. The needs of the companies in this sector are changing. And so the kind of work we were doing needed to change as well. And so for the last 18 months or 2 years almost, we've been putting the building blocks in place to evolve Startup Oz into a sort of broader fit for a new tech sector in Australia. And we've called it the Tech Council of Australia, and we just launched last week.
Yeah, and look, and there's a bit of a who's who in terms of who's on that initial group of members in the advisory council. I mean, do you want to touch on that and how you managed to convince these Goliaths to come on board?
Yeah, there's this phrase that they always say in diplomacy when you're trying to sort of work with people who are going to end up being rich and successful. It's get in on the ground floor, so you can take the elevator up with them. So I guess one of the advantages of working with startups is that they're going to go on to be the elite of the tech sector, but they weren't necessarily when you met them. So look, the Tech Council has got, for me, it's the who's who of Australian tech. It's, the board is chaired by Robin Denham, who is the global chair of Tesla and a partner at Blackbird Ventures. It's got the CEOs of some of the biggest names in the business. Scott Farquhar from Atlassian and Ant Eisen from Afterpay, Cliff Obrecht from Canva, Mina from Different, a couple of former politicians, Wyatt Roy and Kate Jones, Didier Elzinger from CultureAmp. So really some of the best people in Australian tech and political innovation policy. And the answer is we'd been working with them for years, and they were really passionate about helping grow this sector. And so they've committed to, be members of the organization, founding members, and to join the board to try and, make a big splash.
And how does that work? I mean, so the board gets together, I'm suspecting it's once a month or once every 2 or 3 months. What do they discuss, and what are the objectives?
Yeah, so I mean, effectively, the Tech Council, it's a membership organization backed by, we hope, the most successful tech companies in the country, and that's borne itself out with the founding members. And the point is to try and identify growth areas for Australia where we can design public policy and tell a story about how important tech is for Australia's national economy, so that we can sort of bolster the growth of the sector and hopefully of Australia's economy more broadly. And then also to think really clearly about what the constructive conversation we can have around regulation is, because I think that's a thing that people are worried about. They're worried about tech's interaction with the social contract and with, our lives. And governments are certainly worried about it, not just here, but around the world. And we just haven't had a mature conversation yet with government in Australia about what that should mean and what it should look like. And I think this, for me, is a forum to do that, where we've got the people most invested in the sector sitting around the table and keen to talk in a constructive way with policymakers about how we do something that works for the country and allows us to keep building a really successful industry.
And you've managed to attract, I don't know Kate, but Kate Pounder is the new CEO, and she seems amazing. I mean, why don't you tell us about Kate and why she joined?
Yeah, Kate's brilliant. I mean, most recently, Kate was at Alpha Beta, which is a consultancy that does a lot of work in the tech policy space. She headed up their practice in Canberra, and so has all the right connections with government. And with the right people in government doing tech policy. So she was a partner there, and they got bought by Accenture. It's a bit of a startup success story in itself. They were founded 5 or 6 years ago and then got bought by Accenture last year. And she was, ready for the next thing, which was very lucky for us, because not only has she had a lot of experience in tech policy, but she's whip smart. You know, she was at McKinsey before she was at Alpha Beta. She started up AI groups, technology industry practice before that. And as I say, she knows all the right people in Canberra. So I think she's going to do a super good job for the sector.
Yeah, yeah. No, look, it's great. I was delighted when you actually called me and told me about it before you announced it. And it was like, wow, that sounds like an awesome move. You know, every startup has an origin story. And I know this is a sort of morphing from Startup Oz to the Tech Council. But I mean, what was that moment of epiphany that Alex decided that, you know, it's time to, you know, do something bigger and new and hand over the reins? I mean, because those are all major decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the moment of epiphany around the Tech Council was sort of one of those things that just it creeps up on you a bit. You know, it's hard to pin down exactly when it happens. You see a gap in the market for over a long period. You recognize that actually Atlassian and Afterpay don't have a forum where they can sit down together and be in the same room talking about the public message that the tech sector is sending. And, you know, I sat down with the Startup Oz board at the start of last year and pitched it to them. And they said, yeah, let's do this. This is the future of the organization. And then, you know, a few months after that, I wrote a formal letter to Mike and Scott at Atlassian and said, hey, we're going to need, you know, a real anchor partner here. I think you guys are going to, you know, are going to love this, and we need you. We'd love to have you on board. So that was kind of a catalyzing moment. And they said, yep, we're in. And then it's been just a building process from there. I mean, for me personally, it really is a natural next step for me to sort of hand over the reins to someone else, I think, from an organizational perspective and from a personal perspective for me. But that didn't really happen until it looked like it was actually genuinely going to get off the ground at the start of this year.
Yeah, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, and I think I've told you this privately too. I mean, like, Startup Oz was great, but it always felt a little underpowered. I mean, it had, you know, you were terrific and you had a group of people around you, but there wasn't enough money. And you think of the other successful lobbying groups out there, like the Minerals Council or even the AIC, you know, and they've got, you know, millions and millions in revenue and staff and offices in Canberra and just, you know, people that can get in the face of the politicians and make it happen. And I just felt that, you know, Startup Oz kind of needed to get to that point, but this appears to be the unlocking way to get to that answer. I mean, is that fair?
Yeah, this is that for sure. This is all of those conversations we've had, Ian, and I've had with lots of other people as well about how do we get the backing of the sector. And look, honestly, I don't know if I think 5 or 6 years ago there wasn't the weight in this sector to do that. We were Startup Oz for a reason because we still needed startups, and startups can't, you know, fund an organization to really represent the industry properly. Tech companies can, and now we have a serious tech industry in Australia. You know, we've just produced some research with the launch of the Tech Council, which says it's the third biggest industry in the country now and growing fast, over 800,000 jobs. We want to grow it to 1 million jobs in the next 5 years. A huge GDP impact behind, I think, only mining and banking. And I think it's on the quickest growth trajectory of any industry we've got. So that wasn't there 5, 6 years ago, but it is now. And I think if we can harness some of that, then we can really tell the story more emphatically.
And my suspicion is you deliberately thought about this, but you dropped startup from the title. I mean, do you want to just talk us through? I mean, you must have had a bunch of internal debate about that. So why is startup not part of the organization title?
Yeah, well, it's not part of the title, but it's definitely part of the organization. We've got some representation on the board. It's in the constitution that we're a big part of what we do is represent startups. You know, we're committed to continuing to produce the Crossroads, and Startup Oz is sort of folded informally to the organization. So it is a big part of the organization. But I think if you're trying to be an organization that represents the tech sector more broadly, you know, a startup is a stage, right? So you want to be really clear that you're actually representing the full breadth of companies across the sector. And it just made sense to be really clear about that in the name. I think as well, if you're trying to get traction with the public or with politicians, you want to bring the best face you can. And frankly, you know, when you sit down and say we represent startups, people think that you're talking about some, as I was once told by the minister when I sat down with him, some hipsters in a cafe in Surry Hills. And you've got to work uphill to kind of get past that initial impression. So if you can not give yourself that handicap, it's probably a good idea.
Yeah. And how do you think you're going to play with the other? Because there's other people in this space. So you've got the ACS, the Australian Computer Society, and, you know, maybe, I mean, it's different, but the AIC has maybe some tiny bit of crossover here. But when you look at the ACS, for example, like where do you differ and where are you similar?
Yeah, well, I mean, the ACS really is it's a professional body. They've got, most of the members are sort of systems engineers, computer engineers, software developers and coders. And so that's more like the sort of law society where they're representing the interests of people, and we've got companies as members. I think, honestly, this is such a big and growing industry. There is space for different angles to take on it. And I think there are a couple of other organizations that do a great job in this sector that we want to work closely with and collaborate with. I mean, you know, we already are doing some stuff with AIC, that's just the Australian Investment Council, for anyone who is listening who doesn't know that. And they used to be AVCAL, and they do a great job in representing the interests of investors. And we are, you know, planning to work really closely with them on some of that stuff. So I don't see this as a competitive environment. I think it's really a collaborative environment right across the industry.
Yeah. Let me maybe bring up another topic that you and I have talked about ad infinitum over the years, like data, or data, as some other people say, but I think Scottish is data. You know, like, Australia doesn't have, you know, good depth of data. I mean, the there is no Mattermark or Crunchbase or PitchBook. I mean, they're here and they're active, but the quality is just not great. Is that an issue? And is Tech Council going to be able to do anything about it, or is that going to be up to others?
Yeah, I think it's an issue. I think some of those that you mentioned are getting better. Like PitchBook has been getting better over the years that we've been using them to produce the Crossroads. I think there are some local efforts that are also getting a lot better. Tech Board has been doing a great job, the guys based out of Melbourne.
We should call it Tech Board out of Perth.
Yeah, and we've already had some conversations about working with them. And I know that there are some national data collection efforts that are sort of spinning up within government, particularly within the federal government, and state governments around the country, and probably led by LaunchVic down in Victoria, have started doing some of their own data collection and working with international outfits like Startup Genome. So, I mean, those are disparate, and you'd rather one big, excellent data set. I think for a market that isn't the focus of most of the best data collecting companies in the world, we're doing what we can. And if we can help to boost that at the Tech Council, I think that would be a great thing for us to do.
Yeah. Another topic, the IPCC, which is the UN body that just released, you know, like 280 scientists globally came up with it and said, yes, we are absolutely effed as a planet and maybe as a species. You know, and this may be a little tangential to the question, but I mean, is this, you know, climate change and our responsibility as humans and, you know, businesses, especially at this innovative end of the spectrum, is Tech Council going to be doing anything around that? Is that part of the mandate?
Look, it's something I'm personally really passionate about. I'm doing actually quite a lot of stuff around climate tech here at Stanford. It's not on the initial agenda for the Tech Council. You know, one of our philosophies in getting this thing off the ground was to stay really focused. One of the things about technology is that it's a horizontal as much as it's a vertical. So it underpins so many other industries, and you can, I think, have a conversation about lots of different things and nothing all at once if you're not careful. So we've said we want to really focus in the first year or two on conversations about policy settings that are going to help Australia build a world-leading tech sector and boost growth here as a result. And then we're going to have some conversations about where we go next, whether it's on regulation or, you know, environmental or other issues. But, you know, we want to be really laser focused at the start.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe a good chance just to talk about what you're doing at Stanford. I mean, apart from being a beautiful place and, you know, but an hour's drive, well, depends on traffic, drive south of San Francisco. Like, what is your plan and why are you at Stanford?
Yeah, so I'm doing a one-year master's in business here at the Stanford GSB, the Graduate School of Business.
So is that basically an MBA? Is that the same
thing? So they do an accelerated MBA for mid-career professionals, you know, old guys like me. I'm here during the summer. You're not old. 36 is old in this world.
Oh my God.
So young. So you do an accelerated course over summer to catch up on the core components, and then I'm just about to get into some electives next month and do the rest of the – so join the MBA 2s and the rest of the program. So, yeah.
And what's it like? Who else is on the course? I mean, yeah, tell us about life at Stanford.
Yeah, well, so I've only met the other oldies, which means that they've already had – intimidatingly successful careers, a lot of them. There's an Olympic gold medalist. There's some special forces guys.
Really? What sport?
Skiing, mogul skiing for Canada.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, that's full on.
Former congressman from Colombia, Delta Force guys from the US military, a top cyber guy in Israel, some very cool people to hang out with. And that's one of the joys of a place like this, is that it sort of attracts people from all over the world who are going to enrich each other. So that's a real plus.
Yeah. And you're in, you know, relative COVID-free bliss. Is that right? So you're kind of no lockdown. I mean, like, are there any restrictions that you have right now?
Some. I mean, we're wearing masks in class, and I think you've got to be careful because there is a bit of a spike in cases over here. And, you know, people are sort of looking at the Delta variant and thinking – this could upset our reopening plans. On campus at Stanford, you know, vaccination rates are over 90%, so that's pretty good. It's pretty easy to get a vaccine here. For those who didn't have it when they got here, they just got jabbed straight away. We're doing weekly testing. They've got really easy kind of 24-hour test kits that you just administer yourself and drop in a box. So that's pretty cool. No lockdown, which is absolutely fantastic. And you know, I guess the message is there is kind of life on the other side of lockdown.
yeah, I can't wait. Are you allowed to go to a bar and consume alcohol vertically?
You're allowed to sit or stand. Which is wow. Wild. Dancing.
Can you dance and sing?
Yes.
What about you singing? Like, you've got an amazing singing voice, I've heard.
Yeah, if you like, you can sing.
Oh my God. Yeah. And I mean, from what I've heard, like, I've never done an MBA, but people that have told me say it is a ridiculous amount of work. It's way more than you think. You think it's going to be a bit of a, you know, swan around sabbatical and just, you know, go to the bar and the sports fields, but you are working pretty hard. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I wish you'd told me that before I came over here, Ian.
well, you never asked.
I wouldn't have agreed to do so much work.
You could have saved yourself a bunch of money and a bunch of work.
No, it's hard work. I mean, especially because this is an accelerated course, especially over the summer. So you got to do a lot of catch up. But it's great stuff. I mean, you know, everything from interpersonal dynamics to what is a venture capital deal look like from the bottom to the top to, you know, starting new companies to growing big company, everything. It's very cool.
Is there anything there around policy? I mean, are you able to learn or contribute with what you've learned from your 6 years at Startup Oz and 3 years in the Foreign Service?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so Stanford's reputation is well earned as a place where they really focus on innovation and startups and VC. And it's in Silicon Valley, so in lots of ways, sort of Silicon Valley sprung out of some stuff that's happening at Stanford. And there's quite a lot of focus in some of the courses on how that came to be and how it can be sort of enhanced, replicated, what lessons we can learn from some of the experience here. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to sink my teeth into some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. But look, the reality is the network, I mean, you've just rattled off the type of people you meet there, but it's universal. The people that do an MBA, yeah, it's great what you learn, but it's the people you meet and who become your network, you know, so it helps you get a job and, you know, get intros and just, you know, it's easier to make the change when you know a lot of people, you know, and that's a top tip for any startup founder. I mean, if you're listening and you know, you're not thinking about how to build your network, then you should be, you know, looking. It's pretty hard in the COVID times right now because you just can't get out and about and, you know, you can't bump into someone on Zoom. It's pretty hard. You kind of have to do that. So yeah, you must be excited about the other side of that and having all these buddies that you can pick up the phone to in a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big reason to do a program like this, and having it in person makes it, you know, really activates that bit. I should say, I mean, I think the thing you're describing, the sort of strategic networking thing, is a huge part of what everyone describes as hustle for entrepreneurs, you know, knocking down the right doors and just keeping on knocking despite people telling you to go away and stop bothering them. And it's a thing, there's a mantra here that people say, oh, look, you've got a Stanford email address, and it's a super powerful thing. You should send a lot of emails from your Stanford email address and people will respond to you and they'll want to help you. I think it's actually a bit of a mechanism for people to basically say hustle. They say, you know, my experience has been with a startup I was email address or my personal Gmail address, if you've got the right message and you're sending enough emails and you're making enough phone calls and sending enough texts and going to enough meetups, you'll find people want to help you. People want to help. So ask. And yet, one of the biggest things that the Israelis do well that I learned while I was there is if you don't ask, you don't get. And this is, you know, a big part of what they call chutzpah there. And it's something that we could absolutely import to Australia. And I think it's a big lesson for lots of budding founders.
Yep. No, that is a great tip. All right. Let me ask you a few more questions about the tech council before we jump to the quick fire round. I mean, has the structure changed from the startup Oz, or has it just been reversed in? Like, who owns it?
Yeah.
I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, totally different structure. At Startup Oz, we were a nonprofit backed by basically sponsorship where we could find it. We'd go out and hustle every year. Part of the reason we were under-resourced is we have to hustle every year for the dollars to pay for the team we had in place. So that was research projects and sponsorships and whatever. This is a membership model, like those more traditional industry bodies that you mentioned, or the BCA people will have heard of. Those sorts of organizations are membership organizations paid for by the members. And as is this one, it's still a nonprofit. Who owns it? Good question. I think technically the member companies own it, but it's a nonprofit registered charity. So it's sort of not a, there's no sort of commercial interest in the success of the business.
So is it 100% of the operating revenue comes from members, or is there any government support?
No government support. So 100 at the moment. It's
so 100% from the members.
100% from the members.
Some sponsors, or is sponsor different to a member?
Yeah, I think sponsor is going to be different to member, but we're still sort of working that out as we go. Right, for the launch, it's 100% from members. That's just the really cleanest, simplest way to do it. I think we will probably want to do some commissioned research with some sponsors. We'll probably want to work with some companies who, you know, might not want to be members but want to be involved in some of the work we do around, for example, tech talent or whatever. So definitely keep that door open. I think there's a bit of difficulty with taking government money for an organization like this. I think you've got to be a bit careful about the sort of conflict of interest stuff that presents. That was always a question that we had with Startup Oz as well. We actually had a bit of bad press 4 or 5 years ago. We did a contract with the government to do some research for them with the Department of Industry, and they paid us a bit of money to do that. And we got lambasted in the press for taking money from government. the only other option was to go under. which wouldn't have been great either. But you know, you do have to be really. I think you have to be cognizant of both the potential for conflict of interest and the potential for perceived conflict of interest around taking government money.
But so you've opened the doors. I mean, it's been a month, I think, since the announcement, so probably a bit longer since you've sort of started. So, I mean, who's on the staff now? Is it or the full-time staff? Is it just Kate? I mean, like, or you must have support staff there too? I mean, how does that look?
Yeah, so the team, Kate's building the team at the moment. She's got about 3 or 4 people working for her already, and she's on the hunt for some pretty senior policy people to come in and help her continue to build that team's expertise. The formal launch.
Oh, cool. Well, here's a chance to plug it.
Yeah, well, exactly. Kate at Tech Council. Get in touch with her if you think you're at
techcouncil.com.au.
Yeah, or you can email me, Alex, at techcouncil.com.au, and I can have a chat to anyone who's interested. But yeah, exactly. People who with economics expertise, policy expertise, and tech crossover with those two things, I think, are the key hires. And I was having a chat to Kate yesterday about it, and she's got some great people in mind. So, I mean, the challenge, of course, is trying to get them to come and work for your nonprofit, helping the tech sector, when they could go and work for a big consulting firm and make a pile of money. But we've got the advantage that we're doing something good for Australia and hopefully good for the world. And there's a bit of a mission behind it. So with any luck,
we'll get some good people. Well, look, we should all get our back behind it. So how do we as listeners or startups sign up?
Yeah, so jump onto the website. We've just launched the new website. It's techcouncil.com.au. You can sign up for the newsletter there. You can check out who's involved and what our core sort of initial policy pillars are. There's a contact address there as well if you want to send us a message, inquire about membership, just get in touch to say good day and if you have a question. So strongly encourage people to
come. And is it sorry to interrupt, is it a single tier of membership? I mean, does it cost the same whoever you are?
No, so it's based on company size. So we really wanted to make sure that so that, you know, young companies, growing companies could get involved. So actually, I think Kate's kind of ironing out the detail on that right now. We publicly launched last week, and in the 24 hours or 48 hours after we publicly launched, I think she had 150 new membership inquiries, and we started with 25 founding members. So she's had a bit of an inundation, and that just, you know, she's going to kind of go back to have a look at what the membership model looks like in light of that. But we're having those conversations.
And can you talk about the range of, you know, how much is it likely to cost a startup to join?
Oh yeah, so for the small, at the smallest end, it's sort of a $1,000 a month kind of fee, and up to the biggest end, it's sort of $10,000 a month. So anything in that range, really. We've actually got, I mean, and you don't have to be a paying member to be involved in the kind of stuff we do. So we want to, especially for the smaller businesses, we want to include people rather than exclude them. One of the things that we've done to try and to do more of that is that we've got some of the biggest VC firms on as members. Blackbird, Airtree, Square Peg, our innovation fund, Main Sequence Ventures are all members of the organization. And so their portfolio companies are tapped into what we're doing sort of automatically at sort of a basic membership level. So that kind of, I think, will hopefully help bring some of those voices into the conversation as well.
Yeah, well, as I said, Innovation Bay is very keen to support. I think it's a great initiative and we should all get our back behind it. One more question and then we'll maybe jump to the quickfire unless something else crops up. But what does success look like? You know, so when you look back in your old age, when you get to 40 or whatever, what do you hope to achieve with the Tech Council?
You know, I think if I can talk at a, I think measuring success in public policy advocacy organizations is very hard. I would love to help sort of get some genuine metrics behind this. I think, Ian, one of the very first conversations I had with you, you said, how do you feel about metrics? And I said, if I can find out how to do the metrics for this stuff, I'll feel very good about them. For me, if the thing we can do is elevate the conversation over the next couple of years to the point where we Australians can feel confident that we aren't responding to technology in a knee-jerk way, and where we can feel like we have the capacity and desire to build a globally relevant and highly successful tech industry. For me, that's a huge win. And I don't think we're there at the moment, even though I think we've had a lot of success in building Australia's tech sector. But I think with the right people around the table, we can get there with an organization like this.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it's you know, not high in the government's priority list. I mean, I'm not sure what is. I mean, I don't want to get into government bashing, but you know, the mishandled vaccine rollout and the appalling at the climate change front. I mean, I'm not sure what they're doing well, but you know, we seem to be the afterthought. I mean, they dump, you know. And again, I don't know the guy or the whole story behind it, but they dump what was becoming a toxic minister in Christian Porter on us and take out someone who seemed very effective and good at it in Karen Andrews. And that's not healthy, is it?
Well, I think honestly, the biggest thing for me is that we can do a lot better as an industry. I think we can look at the other side and criticize as much as we like. And, you know, there's no shortage of that around, I think we first look at ourselves and say, have we presented the best face we can to government and frankly to the public? And I think the answer to that clearly is no. It's fractured. You know, of the 25 founding members of the Tech Council, I think one of them had been a member of an industry body before. We just haven't made an effort yet to have a conversation that is really concerted and at the right level. So, you know, I think if we do that and then we're ignored, then we should complain, but we should try a bit harder first.
God, that answer demonstrates you are perfect for this job, because that was a great answer and you didn't say anything negative about the government. I loved it.
Well, it'd be part of my presidential run in 2050.
All right. Well, I don't really have too much else to ask you about the Tech Council and what you're up to. I mean, I think it's awesome. And again, look, just before we jump to the quickfire, just look, congrats and thank you on behalf of the whole sector. And, you know, just personally, I've really enjoyed every interaction with you. I hope we get you back, you know, so don't stay in the US for forever, please.
No way.
You know, get your MBA and come home and start a great business. We'll welcome you back with open arms. And attract all your mates too, you know, because we're going to need some imported talent in a few years.
I'm over here recruiting for Australia. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, good. That's the correct answer. Yeah. Even better. All right, shall we do the quick fire round then, Alex? So, and I gave you the warning to this about 40 minutes ago, so that was pretty organized of me. So I'm glad you've got your list ready. Do you have a book recommendation?
I've got a series of books by Colin McCullough. Actually, do they have to be industry books, or are we doing just anything?
No. Nope.
All right, a series of books by Colin McCullough about ancient.
Colleen or Colin?
Colleen McCullough.
Okay. Sounds Scottish.
She's Australian, but I think she's from Norfolk Island. Oh. Series of books about ancient Rome, and particularly the rise of Julius Caesar. Historical fiction-ish, where she sort of puts a bit of colour on, but very well researched and just my sort of thing. If people are into it, then I think it's called the Masters of Rome series, 6,000 or 7,000-page books.
That's quite a weighty tome. Like, I presume, like, and how do you read them? Are you Kindle, hard copy, Audible? Like, what's the preferred?
When I read them in hard copy because it was 7 or 8 years ago. But these days, definitely Kindle and WhisperSync with the Audible version. I can't get enough of it. You know, you wake up in the morning, you read a few pages, you get in the shower, you put the Audible version on, you get on the bus, you're back on the Kindle. It's amazing.
You know, I've never tried the WhisperSync, so you'd recommend it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just before.
Because it gets frustrating because I end up, I've got one book running on Kindle and one book running on Audible, and then I kind of get confused.
No, sync them up. You can do, I mean, the Kindle will remember where you're up to on the audiobook, and then the audiobook will remember where you're up to on the Kindle.
This is why you're 36 and I'm 50 and 2 weeks.
Used to work for Amazon. Come on.
Yeah, I know I did. Yeah, anyway, that was a while ago. All right, well, that's awesome. Thank you. Podcast.
One of my favorite podcasts in the last little while has been Reply All, which is a Gimlet podcast about the internet. And I think it's basically cancelled this year. They got into a bit of strife with a story they did, and yeah, they got, in the new sense of the word cancelled, they got cancelled.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't often hear that story. Mm. I think that's the first podcast I've heard about that's ever been, you know, sued or threatened out of existence.
Yeah, well, they basically did the wrong story. They did a story about another company and their, you know, problems with race in the team and in the hiring practices, and it bubbled up that they had some problems with race in the team and their hiring practices on the podcast. And they had to cut the multi-part story halfway through, and I think haven't produced an episode since, and it's been 6 or 8 months. So, you know, one of the producers and one of the co-hosts had to resign, and it all fell over. Glass houses and all
that. We probably should watch our step. In fact, I called Christian Porter toxic. So sorry, Christian, please don't sue us.
I don't think you're at risk of getting cancelled, Ian. You're okay.
Okay, good. Yeah, but you know, he does sue people. He sued the ABC, didn't he? Anyway, let's not dwell on that. Can you tell us about favorite news source?
Look, I've always loved The Economist. And these days I'm doing The Economist by audio as well, which I think they sort of led the charge on news by audio. Actually, they've had a great audio version for as long as I can remember, like 8 or 9 years.
I agree. That is my go-to. Comes out Friday morning here. I can get through it normally by Sunday. 2x speed is the only way because it's quite slow, that one.
No, I'm a 1x speed guy.
2x is about right.
It's
even with The Economist.
It's an art. They produce such a beautiful...
How can you read thousands of words of Roman history and then also The Economist in one time speed. You do it at the same time?
One thing at a time. For things which is just information, I'm okay with two times, but The Economist is beautiful. It's beautifully produced. I want to hear the dulcet tones.
Oh, well, good to know. Maybe try 1.5. I mean, just do me a favor. Right, I just want to see you being more efficient. In fact, that's the next question. Like, what is your favorite productivity tool?
I've got
because it's not listening to The Economist at 2x speed.
Yeah. I don't know if this counts as a productivity tool, but I'm a huge evangelist for an app called TripIt. And maybe it's rubbing it in because no one's traveling at the moment, but it's a thing that basically you give it access to your Gmail and it'll read your emails as they come in and automatically put together, it recognizes confirmations from airlines and hotels and bus companies and, you know, scuba diving places or whatever, and it puts together your travel itinerary for you. So you've got an offline already downloaded, there's your ticket number and your confirmation number and your map to your next hotel location and whatever. Stunning, a beautiful piece of technology.
That is pretty cool. I think, was it bought by Concur?
Yeah, exactly.
I can't remember. I think, it's free. And I can see why when you're owned by Concur. So yeah, no, that's a very cool one. No one's ever said that. So thanks for that.
I'm very passionate about it. And actually coming to the States, I had to fill out, you know, the last 5 times I'd been to the US in the last 10 years and where, like, every country I've ever been to over the last 10 years. And actually I realized I've been using TripIt for 10 years. And so I actually literally had every trip I've been on for the last 10 years sitting there in my past trips. Took me, what would have taken me hours, took me 10 minutes.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. Favorite app. So when you pull out your phone and you're not going to Gmail, what do you look at? I mean, you can say Gmail if you want, but that'd be very
honestly
boring.
I've used so much WhatsApp. Just phone calls, you know, from over here, I'm doing all my catch-ups on video WhatsApp calls. I'm on a billion WhatsApp threads. Everything is being done by WhatsApp here in terms of, like, class coordination and whatever. So I probably have to say WhatsApp. I probably do, you know, 15 hours a week on WhatsApp or something.
Yeah. How do you think about WhatsApp versus Slack? Because, you know, we had, like, Innovation Bay, we had this debate. I mean, I was kind of pro WhatsApp, but that was when the team was like 4 or 5. Now we're at 10. I actually think Slack's pretty good, but have you got thoughts on that one?
Yeah. I mean, we use Slack as well at Startup Oz and now Tech Council for the team stuff. I think it's nice to have kind of a separation of the work stuff and the WhatsApp. You know, but obviously you can't have, it's not quite as inclusive, Slack, right? Like, deliberately, you've got your team on there and you want to have it dedicated to particular topics. Whereas, I don't know, WhatsApp, I'm on WhatsApp threads about everything under the sun. In fact, I've probably got 15 threads of exactly the same people with just, you know, all my mates from university and their partners and with just different topics. So we'll have a thread about politics and a thread about rugby and a thread about the Olympics and...
Wow, your WhatsApp must be busy.
I reckon I get, I just checked my data on it the other day. I think I sent 180,000 WhatsApp messages since I first installed it and received more than that. So yeah, it's busy.
That's amazing. I've never checked that statistic. I might just have to go and have a look after this. Now, this next question will be interesting. And in fact, I'll give you more than one answer if you like. And that is your favorite tech CEO.
I should say all of the tech CEOs of all the member companies of the Tech Council, but I'm gonna exclude Australian companies because otherwise I'm playing favorites. I think
that's okay. No one's listening. it's just you and me.
Look, from an inspiration perspective, I sort of was finishing school and going to uni around the time the iPod came out and Apple was kind of reinventing itself, and I just think from a fascination perspective, it's really hard to go past Steve Jobs, like a really unique character, an incredible business leader. Not sure if you'd want to have dinner with him or if you'd want to be his buddy, but he's like,
unique,
very unique, and sort of remade the world in lots of ways. So probably Steve Jobs.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, you know, maybe it's because he's not been around for a few years, but he's definitely not been high on the list of that answer. Any others, or are you just going to stick with one?
I mean, kind of boring, but pretty hard for me to look past Musk as well. And maybe I'm attracted to the, like, eccentric, difficult. hard to understand founder CEOs, but both those guys have just upended industries, the way we think about the world. They've got big visions and they made them happen. I think that's really inspiring.
Yeah. No, I think that is spot on. Yeah. And I just, you know, look on with my jaw open at what Musk is doing with SpaceX and Tesla in particular, but Neuralink, Boring, Sun City, I mean, it's, you name it, he's affected the industry in a way that has made the world a lot better, I think. Favorite TV show or movie?
Do you know, I think I'm giving up TV for the year here at Stanford. I'm here just for, you know, sort of feeling like it's 12 months and I haven't watched a TV episode in the month that I've been here. And I feel like I might be able to go another 11 months without watching TV, having watched so much TV in the 12 months or 18 months before I got here, thanks to COVID. So hopefully nothing over the next little while. Historically, The West Wing, for me, that's why I got in. I actually joined the government because I was so inspired by The West Wing, which is kind of cheesy and probably a bad reason to go down a career path.
That's like people becoming lawyers because they've watched Suits, is that right?
Well, I was also a lawyer, and I, you know, my mum used to watch a lot of The Practice when I was a kid, and Ally McBeal. So maybe that's why.
I'm sure it must be funded by the Law Society because, believe me, people, like being a lawyer is not as glamorous as it comes across in Suits.
Yeah, I think that's definitely.
I say believe me, I'm not a lawyer, by the way, but Andrea, my other half here, was an ex-lawyer and she got out of it. And it was definitely, the lawyers, you know, it's not super glamorous. It's an important job, but I wouldn't say it's glamorous.
I watched Rake recently for the first time and loved it. And that struck me as quite similar to what being a lawyer was like for lots of lawyers. So I don't know if you've seen Rake, but it's interesting. Much less,
I might have to go
much
watch
less
it
glamorous. Much more gritty.
All right, Alex, very last question. If you get called by TED and said, Alex, can you come and do a TED talk? You've got 15 minutes to talk about, you know, your passion area. What would that be?
I think I'd want to talk about the role that we all have and consumers have in solving climate change. I think there's a lot of talk about the role that governments have and the role that organizations have, but I actually think I'm really passionate about this idea that actually we have a lot of power to do something, one of the things I want to do here at Stanford is explore ways that we can amplify consumer power to directly impact their own carbon footprint and help do something about climate change directly.
Yeah. And what's the punchline? It's kind of eat less meat, ride a bicycle instead of driving a car, and don't travel as much. Use Zoom.
So this is part of the problem. I think this is the punchline, is like, here's a few things, you know, put some solar panels on the roof of your house maybe as well. Like maybe think about what energy provider you know, use less air conditioning. But there's like, it's actually pretty limited. And one of the things that I've been looking at is actually household grocery is like 20 to 30% of total carbon footprint. I want to see if there's a way we can get people to contribute for some of the externalities that produces. So next time we talk, we can talk about that directly.
All right. Well, look, Alex, I could have chatted with you for ages. This is often nice. I haven't spoken to you for a while, so it's just nice maybe recording a, you know, casual pub style conversation. But, look, great work with the Tech Council. I'm so glad you got it off the ground. Best of luck in Stanford. If the borders open and you're still there at some point next year and I'm over in the vicinity, then I'm going to come and visit. Be nice to hang out over there.
A proper pub style conversation.
Look, keep in touch. Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah, or maybe, look forward to seeing you when you get back. So, but look, Alex, thanks for your time. I know it's evening over there. You probably got to get down the pub now. So, but good luck with it and we'll see you soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks everyone. Very much, Ian. Great to be here.